a subordinate babbler attempts to offer food to a dominant individual, the apparent generosity is violently rebuffed. The essence of Zahavi's idea is that advertisements of superiority are authenticated by their cost. Only a genuinely superior individual can afford to advertise the fact by means of a costly gift. Individuals buy success, for example in attracting mates, through costly demonstrations of superiority, including ostentatious generosity and public-spirited risk-taking. We now have four good Darwinian reasons for individuals to be altruistic, generous, or moral towards each other. First, there is the special case of genetic kinship. Second, there is reciprocation, the repayment of favors given and the giving of favors in anticipation of payback. Following on from this, there is, third, the Darwinian benefit of acquiring a reputation for generosity and kindness. And fourth, if Zahavi is right, there is the particular additional benefit of conspicuous generosity as a way of buying unfakeably authentic advertising. Through most of our prehistory, humans lived under conditions that would have strongly favored the evolution of all four kinds of altruism. We lived in villages, or earlier in discrete roving bands like baboons, partially isolated from neighboring bands or villages. Most of your fellow band members would have been kin, more closely related to you than members of other bands. Plenty of opportunities for kin altruism to evolve. And whether kin or not, you would tend to meet the same individuals again and again throughout your life. Ideal conditions for the evolution of reciprocal altruism. Those are also the ideal conditions for building a reputation for altruism, and the very same ideal conditions for advertising conspicuous generosity. By any or all of the four routes, genetic tendencies towards altruism would have been favored in early humans. It is easy to see why our prehistoric ancestors would have been good to their own in-group, but bad, to the point of xenophobia, towards other groups. But why, now that most of us live in big cities where we are no longer surrounded by kin, and where every day we meet individuals whom we are never going to meet again, why are we still so good to each other? Even sometimes to others who might be thought to belong to an out-group.
It is important not to misstate the reach of natural selection. Selection does not favour the evolution of a cognitive awareness of what is good for your genes. That awareness had to wait for the 20th century to reach a cognitive level, and even now full understanding is confined to a minority of scientific specialists. What natural selection favours is rules of thumb, which work in practice to promote the genes that built them. Rules of thumb, by their nature, sometimes misfire. In a bird's brain, the rule, look after small squawking things in your nest and drop food into their red gapes, typically has the effect of preserving the genes that built the rule, because the squawking, gaping objects in an adult bird's nest are normally its own offspring. The rule misfires if another baby bird somehow gets into the nest, a circumstance that is positively engineered by cuckoos. Could it be that our Good Samaritan urges are misfirings, analogous to the misfiring of a reed warbler's parental instincts when it works itself to the bone for a young cuckoo? An even closer analogy is the human urge to adopt a child. I must rush to add that misfiring is intended only in a strictly Darwinian sense. It carries no suggestion of the pejorative. The mistake, or byproduct idea, which I'm espousing, works like this. Natural selection in ancestral times when we lived in small and stable bands like baboons programmed into our brains altruistic urges alongside sexual urges, hunger urges, xenophobic urges, and so on. An intelligent couple can read their Darwin and know that the ultimate reason for their sexual urges is procreation. They know that the woman cannot conceive because she is on the pill. Yet they find that their sexual desire is in no way diminished by the knowledge. Sexual desire is sexual desire, and its force, in an individual's psychology, is independent of the ultimate Darwinian pressure that drove it. It is a strong urge which exists independently of its ultimate rationale. I am suggesting that the same is true of the urge to kindness, to altruism, to generosity, to empathy, to pity. In ancestral times, we had the opportunity to be altruistic only towards close kin and potential reciprocators. Nowadays, that restriction is no longer there, but the rule of thumb persists. Why would it not? It is just like sexual desire. We can no more help ourselves feeling pity when we see a weeping unfortunate, who is unrelated and unable to reciprocate, than we can help ourselves feeling lust for a member of the opposite sex, who may be infertile or otherwise unable to reproduce. Both are misfirings, Darwinian mistakes, blessed, precious mistakes. Do not for one moment think of such Darwinizing as demeaning or reductive of the noble emotions of compassion and generosity. Nor of sexual desire. Sexual desire, when channeled through the conduits of linguistic culture, emerges as great poetry and drama. John Donne's love poems, say, or Romeo and Juliet. And of course, the same thing happens with the misfired redirection of kin and reciprocation-based compassion. Mercy to a debtor is, when seen out of context, as un-Darwinian as adopting someone else's child.
The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath.
Sexual lust is the driving force behind a large proportion of human ambition and struggle, and much of it constitutes a misfiring. There is no reason why the same should not be true of the lust to be generous and compassionate, if this is the misfired consequence of ancestral village life. The best way for natural selection to build in both kinds of lust in ancestral times was to install rules of thumb in the brain. Those rules still influence us today, even where circumstances make them inappropriate to their original functions. Such rules of thumb influence us still, not in a Calvinistically deterministic way, but filter through the civilizing influences of literature and custom, law and tradition, and of course religion. Just as the primitive brain rule of sexual lust passes through the filter of civilization to emerge in the love scenes of Romeo and Juliet, so primitive brain rules of us versus them vendetta emerge in the form of the running battles between Capulets and Montagues, while primitive brain rules of altruism and empathy end up in the misfiring that cheers us in the chastened reconciliation of Shakespeare's final scene.
A case study in the roots of morality. If our moral sense, like our sexual desire, is indeed rooted deep in our Darwinian past, predating religion, we should expect that research on the human mind would reveal some moral universals, crossing geographical and cultural barriers and also, crucially, religious barriers. The Harvard biologist Mark Hauser, in his book Moral Minds, How Nature Designed Our Universal Sense of Right and Wrong, has enlarged upon a fruitful line of thought experiments originally suggested by moral philosophers. Hauser's study will serve the additional purpose of introducing the way moral philosophers think. A hypothetical moral dilemma is posed, and the difficulty we experience in answering it tells us something about our sense of right and wrong. Where Hauser goes beyond the philosophers is that he actually does statistical surveys and psychological experiments, using questionnaires on the internet, for example, to investigate the moral sense of real people. From the present point of view, the interesting thing is that most people come to the same decisions when faced with these dilemmas, and their agreement over the decisions themselves is stronger than their ability to articulate their reasons. That is what we should expect if we have a moral sense which is built into our brains, like our sexual instinct or our fear of heights or, as Hauser himself prefers to say, like our capacity for language. The details vary from culture to culture, but the underlying deep structure of grammar is universal. As we shall see, the way people respond to these moral tests and their inability to articulate their reasons seems largely independent of their religious beliefs or lack of them. The message of Hauser's book, to anticipate it in his own words, is this.
Driving our moral judgments is a universal moral grammar, a faculty of the mind that evolved over millions of years to include a set of principles for building a range of possible moral systems. As with language, the principles that make up our moral grammar fly beneath the radar of our awareness.
Typical of Hauser's moral dilemmas are variations on the theme of a runaway truck, or trolley, on a railway line which threatens to kill a number of people. The simplest story imagines a person, Denise, standing by a set of points and in a position to divert the trolley onto a siding, thereby saving the lives of 5 people trapped on the main line ahead. Unfortunately, there is a man trapped on the siding. But since he is only 1, outnumbered by the 5 people trapped on the main track, most people agree that it is morally permissible, if not obligatory, for Denise to throw the switch and save the 5 by killing the 1. We ignore hypothetical possibilities such as that the 1 man on the siding might be Beethoven or a close friend. Elaborations of the thought experiment present a series of increasingly teasing moral conundrums. What if the trolley can be stopped by dropping a large weight in its path from a bridge overhead? That's easy, obviously, we must drop the weight. But what if the only large weight available is a very fat man sitting on the bridge admiring the sunset? Almost everybody agrees that it is immoral to push the fat man off the bridge, even though, from one point of view, the dilemma might seem parallel to Denise's, where throwing the switch kills 1 to save 5. Most of us have a strong intuition that there is a crucial difference between the 2 cases, though we may not be able to articulate what it is. Pushing the fat man off the bridge is reminiscent of another dilemma considered by Hauser. 5 patients in a hospital are dying, each with a different organ failing. Each would be saved if a donor could be found for their particular faulty organ, but none is available. Then the surgeon notices that there is a healthy man in the waiting room, all 5 of whose organs are in good working order and suitable for transplanting. In this case, almost nobody can be found who is prepared to say that the moral act is to kill the 1 to save the 5. As with the fat man on the bridge, the intuition that most of us share is that an innocent bystander should not suddenly be dragged into a bad situation and used for the sake of others without his consent. Immanuel Kant famously articulated the principle that a rational being should never be used as merely an unconsenting means to an end, even the end of benefiting others. This seems to provide the crucial difference between the case of the fat man on the bridge, or the man in the hospital waiting room, and the man on Denise's siding. The fat man on the bridge is being positively used as the means to stop the runaway trolley. This clearly violates the Kantian principle. The person on the siding is not being used to save the lives of the 5 people on the line. It is the siding that is being used, and he just has the bad luck to be standing on it. But when you put the distinction like that, why does it satisfy us? For Kant, it was a moral absolute. For Hauser, it is built into us by our evolution. The hypothetical situations involving the runaway trolley become increasingly ingenious, and the moral dilemmas correspondingly tortuous. Hauser contrasts the dilemmas faced by hypothetical individuals called Ned and Oscar. Ned is standing by the railway track. Unlike Denise, who could divert the trolley onto a siding, Ned's switch diverts it onto a side loop, which joins the main track again just before the 5 people. Simply switching the points doesn't help. The trolley will plough into the 5 anyway when the diversion rejoins the main track. However, as it happens, there is an extremely fat man on the diversionary track who is heavy enough to stop the trolley. Should Ned change the points and divert the train? Most people's intuition is that he should not. But what is the difference between Ned's dilemma and Denise's? Presumably, people are intuitively applying Kant's principle. Denise diverts the trolley from ploughing into the 5 people, and the unfortunate casualty on the siding is collateral damage, to use the charmingly Rumsfeldian phrase. He's not being used by Denise to save the others. Ned is actually using the fat man to stop the trolley. And most people, perhaps unthinkingly, along with Kant, thinking it out in great detail, see this as a crucial difference.
The difference is brought out again by the dilemma of Oscar. Oscar's situation is identical to Ned's, except that there is a large iron weight on the diversionary loop of track, heavy enough to stop the trolley. Clearly, Oscar should have no problem in deciding to pull the points and divert the trolley. Except that there happens to be a hiker walking in front of the iron weight. He will certainly be killed if Oscar pulls the switch, just as surely as Ned's fat man. The difference is that Oscar's hiker is not being used to stop the trolley. he is collateral damage, as in Denise's dilemma. Like Hauser, and like most of Hauser's experimental subjects, I feel that Oscar is permitted to throw the switch, but Ned is not. But I also find it quite hard to justify my intuition. Hauser's point is that such moral intuitions are often not well thought out, but that we feel them strongly anyway, because of our evolutionary heritage. In an intriguing venture into anthropology, Hauser and his colleagues adapted their moral experiments to the Kuna, a small Central American tribe with little contact with Westerners and no formal religion. The researchers changed the trolley on a line thought experiment to locally suitable equivalents, such as crocodiles swimming towards canoes. With corresponding minor differences, the Kuna show the same moral judgments as the rest of us. Of particular interest for this book, Hauser also wondered whether religious people differ from atheists in their moral intuitions. Surely, if we get our morality from religion, they should differ. But it seems that they don't. Hauser, working with the moral philosopher Peter Singer, focused on three hypothetical dilemmas and compared the verdicts of atheists with those of religious people. In each case, the subjects were asked to choose whether a hypothetical action is morally obligatory, permissible, or forbidden. The three dilemmas were...
1. Denise's dilemma. 90% of people said it was permissible to divert the trolley, killing the one to save the five. 2. You see a child drowning in a pond and there is no other help in sight. You can save the child, but your trousers will be ruined in the process. 97% agreed that you should save the child. Amazingly, 3% apparently would prefer to save their trousers. 3. The organ transplant dilemma described above. 97% of subjects agreed that it is morally forbidden to seize the healthy person in the waiting room and kill him for his organs, thereby saving five other people.
The main conclusion of Hauser and Singer's study was that there is no statistically significant difference between atheists and religious believers in making these judgments. This seems compatible with the view, which I and many others hold, that we do not need God in order to be good or evil. If there is no God, why be good? Posed like that, the question sounds positively ignoble. When a religious person puts it to me in this way, and many of them do, my immediate temptation is to issue the following challenge. Do you really mean to tell me the only reason you try to be good is to gain God's approval and reward, or to avoid his disapproval and punishment? That's not morality, that's just sucking up, apple polishing, looking over your shoulder at the great surveillance camera in the sky, or the still small wiretap inside your head, monitoring your every move, even your every base thought. As Einstein said,
if people are good only because they fear punishment and hope for reward, then we are a sorry lot indeed.
Michael Shermer, in The Science of Good and Evil, calls it a debate stopper. If you agree that, in the absence of God, you would commit robbery, rape, and murder, you reveal yourself as an immoral person, and we would be well advised to steer a wide course around you. If, on the other hand, you admit that you would continue to be a good person even when not under divine surveillance, you have fatally undermined your claim that God is necessary for us to be good. I suspect that quite a lot of religious people do think religion is what motivates them to be good, especially if they belong to one of those faiths that systematically exploits personal guilt. It seems to me to require quite a low self-regard to think that, should belief in God suddenly vanish from the world, we would all become callous and selfish hedonists with no kindness, no charity, no generosity, nothing that would deserve the name of goodness. It is widely believed that Dostoevsky was of that opinion, presumably because of some remarks he put into the mouth of Ivan Karamazov.
Ivan solemnly observed that there was absolutely no law of nature to make man love humanity, and that if love did exist, and had existed at all in the world up to now, then it was not by virtue of the natural law, but entirely because man believed in his own immortality. He added as an aside that it was precisely that which constituted the natural law, namely that once man's faith in his own immortality was destroyed, not only would his capacity for love be exhausted, but so would the vital forces that sustain life on this earth. And furthermore, nothing would be immoral then, everything would be permitted, even anthropophagy. And finally, as though all this were not enough, he declared that for every individual, such as you and me, for example, who does not believe either in God or in his own immortality, the natural law is bound immediately to become the complete opposite of the religion-based law that preceded it, and that egoism, even extending to the perpetration of crime, would not only be permissible, but would be recognized as the essential, the most rational, and even the noblest raison d'être of the human condition.
Perhaps naively, I have inclined towards a less cynical view of human nature than Ivan Karamazov. Do we really need policing, whether by God or by each other, in order to stop us from behaving in a selfish and criminal manner? I dearly want to believe that I do not need such surveillance, and nor, dear reader, do you. On the other hand, just to weaken our confidence, listen to Steven Pinker's disillusioning experience of a police strike in Montreal, which he describes in The Blank Slate.
As a young teenager, in proudly peaceable Canada during the romantic 1960s, I was a true believer in Bakunin's anarchism. I laughed off my parents' argument that if the government ever laid down its arms, all hell would break loose. Our competing predictions were put to the test at 8 a.m. on October the 17th, 1969, when the Montreal police went on strike. By 11:20 a.m., the first bank was robbed. By noon, most downtown stores had closed because of looting. Within a few more hours, taxi drivers burned down the garage of a limousine service that competed with them for airport customers. A rooftop sniper killed a provincial police officer, rioters broke into several hotels and restaurants, and a doctor slew a burglar in his suburban home. By the end of the day, 6 banks had been robbed, 100 shops had been looted, 12 fires had been set, 40 carloads of storefront glass had been broken, and $3 million in property damage had been inflicted before city authorities had to call in the army and, of course, the Mounties to restore order. This decisive empirical test left my politics in tatters.
Perhaps I, too, am a Pollyanna to believe that people would remain good when unobserved and unpoliced by God. On the other hand, the majority of the population of Montreal presumably believed in God. Why didn't the fear of God restrain them when earthly policemen were temporarily removed from the scene? Wasn't the Montreal strike a pretty good natural experiment to test the hypothesis that belief in God makes us good? Or did the cynic H.L. Mencken get it right when he tartly observed,
"People say we need religion when what they really mean is we need police."
Obviously, not everybody in Montreal behaved badly as soon as the police were off the scene. It would be interesting to know whether there was any statistical tendency, however slight, for religious believers to loot and destroy less than unbelievers. My uninformed prediction would have been opposite. It is often cynically said that there are no atheists in foxholes. I'm inclined to suspect, with some evidence, although it may be simplistic to draw conclusions from it, that there are very few atheists in prisons. I'm not necessarily claiming that atheism increases morality, although humanism, the ethical system that often goes with atheism, probably does. Another good possibility is that atheism is correlated with some third factor, such as higher education, intelligence, or reflectiveness, which might counteract criminal impulses. Such research evidence as there is certainly doesn't support the common view that religiosity is positively correlated with morality. Correlational evidence is never conclusive, but the following data, described by Sam Harris in his Letter to a Christian Nation, are nevertheless striking.
While political party affiliation in the United States is not a perfect indicator of religiosity, it is no secret that the red, Republican states, are primarily red due to the overwhelming political influence of conservative Christians. If there were a strong correlation between Christian conservatism and societal health, we might expect to see some sign of it in red state America. We don't. Of the 25 cities with the lowest rates of violent crime, 62% are in blue, Democrat states, and 38% are in red, Republican states. Of the 25 most dangerous cities, 76% are in red states and 24% are in blue states. In fact, 3 of the 5 most dangerous cities in the U.S. are in the pious state of Texas. The 12 states with the highest rates of burglary are red. 24 of the 29 states with the highest rates of theft are red. Of the 22 states with the highest rates of murder, 17 are red. Note that these color conventions in America are exactly the opposite of those in Britain, where blue is the color of the Conservative Party and red, as in the rest of the world, is the color traditionally associated with the political left.
Systematic research, if anything, tends to support such correlational data. Dan Dennett, in Breaking the Spell, sardonically comments not on Harris's book in particular, but on such studies generally.
Needless to say, these results strike so hard at the standard claims of greater moral virtue among the religious that there has been a considerable surge of further research initiated by religious organizations attempting to refute them. One thing we can be sure of is that if there is a significant positive relationship between moral behavior and religious affiliation, practice, or belief, it will soon be discovered, since so many religious organizations are eager to confirm their traditional beliefs about this scientifically. They are quite impressed with the truth-finding power of science when it supports what they already believe. Every month that passes without such a demonstration underlines the suspicion that it just isn't so.
Most thoughtful people would agree that morality in the absence of policing is somehow more truly moral than the kind of false morality that vanishes as soon as the police go on strike or the spy camera is switched off, whether the spy camera is a real one monitored in the police station or an imaginary one in heaven. But it is perhaps unfair to interpret the question, if there is no God, why bother to be good, in such a cynical way. A religious thinker could offer a more genuinely moral interpretation along the lines of the following statement from an imaginary apologist. If you don't believe in God, you don't believe there are any absolute standards of morality. With the best will in the world, you may intend to be a good person, but how do you decide what is good and what is bad? Only religion can ultimately provide your standards of good and evil. Without religion, you have to make it up as you go along. That would be morality without a rulebook, morality flying by the seat of its pants. If morality is merely a matter of choice, Hitler could claim to be moral by his own eugenically inspired standards, and all the atheist can do is make a personal choice to live by different lights. The Christian, the Jew, or the Muslim, by contrast, can claim that evil has an absolute meaning, true for all time and in all places, according to which Hitler was absolutely evil.
Even if it were true that we need God to be moral, it would of course not make God's existence more likely, merely more desirable. Many people cannot tell the difference. But that is not the issue here. The imaginary religious apologist has no need to admit that sucking up to God is the religious motive for doing good. Rather, his claim is that wherever the motive to be good comes from, without God, there would be no standard for deciding what is good. We could each make up our own definition of the good and behave accordingly. Moral principles that are based only upon religion, as opposed to, say, the golden rule, which is often associated with religions but can be derived from elsewhere, may be called absolutist. Good is good, and bad is bad, and we don't mess around deciding particular cases by whether, for example, somebody suffers. The religious apologist would claim that only religion can provide a basis for deciding what is good.
Some philosophers, notably Kant, have tried to derive absolute morals from non-religious sources. Though ostensibly a religious man himself, as was almost obligatory in his time, Kant tried to base a morality on duty for duty's sake, rather than for God's. His famous categorical imperative enjoins us to
act only on that maxim whereby thou canst at the same time will that it should become a universal law.
This works tidily for the example of telling lies. Imagine a world in which people told lies as a matter of principle, where lying was regarded as a good and moral thing to do. In such a world, lying itself would cease to have any meaning. Lying needs a presumption of truth for its very definition. If a moral principle is something we should wish everybody to follow, lying cannot be a moral principle because the principle itself would break down in meaninglessness. Lying, as a rule for life, is inherently unstable. More generally, selfishness, or free-riding parasitism on the goodwill of others may work for me as a lone, selfish individual and give me personal satisfaction. But I cannot wish that everybody would adopt selfish parasitism as a moral principle, if only because then I would have nobody to parasitize.
The Kantian imperative seems to work for truth-telling and some other cases. It's not so easy to see how to broaden it to morality generally. Kant notwithstanding, it is tempting to agree with the hypothetical apologist that absolutist morals are usually driven by religion. Is it always wrong to put a terminally ill patient out of her misery at her own request? Is it always wrong to make love to a member of your own sex? Is it always wrong to kill an embryo? There are those who believe so, and their grounds are absolute. They brook no argument or debate. Anybody who disagrees deserves to be shot, metaphorically, of course, not literally, except in the case of some doctors in American abortion clinics. See next chapter. Fortunately, however, morals do not have to be absolute. Moral philosophers are the professionals when it comes to thinking about right and wrong. As Robert Hind succinctly put it, they agree that moral precepts, while not necessarily constructed by reason, should be defensible by reason. They classify themselves in many ways, but in modern terminology the major divide is between deontologists, such as Kant, and consequentialists, including utilitarians, such as Jeremy Bentham, 1748-1832. Deontology is a fancy name for the belief that morality consists in the obeying of rules. It is literally the science of duty, from the Greek for that which is binding. Deontology is not quite the same thing as moral absolutism, but for most purposes in a book about religion, there is no need to dwell on the distinction. Absolutists believe there are absolutes of right and wrong, imperatives whose rightness makes no reference to their consequences. Consequentialists more pragmatically hold that the morality of an action should be judged by its consequences. One version of consequentialism is utilitarianism, the philosophy associated with Bentham, his friend James Mill, 1773-1836, and Mill's son John Stuart Mill, 1806-73. Utilitarianism is often summed up in Bentham's unfortunately imprecise catchphrase, "The greatest happiness of the greatest number is the foundation of morals and legislation."
Not all absolutism is derived from religion. Nevertheless, it is pretty hard to defend absolutist morals on grounds other than religious ones. The only competitor I can think of is patriotism, especially in times of war. As the distinguished Spanish film director Luis Buñuel said,
"God and country are an unbeatable team. They break all records for oppression and bloodshed."
Recruiting officers rely heavily on their victims' sense of patriotic duty. In the First World War, women handed out white feathers to young men not in uniform.
"Oh, we don't want to lose you, but we think you ought to go, for your king and your country both need you so."
People despised conscientious objectors, even those of the enemy country, because patriotism was held to be an absolute virtue. It is hard to get much more absolute than the "my country, right or wrong" of the professional soldier, for the slogan commits you to kill whomever the politicians of some future date might choose to call enemies. Consequentialist reasoning may influence the political decision to go to war, but once war is declared, absolutist patriotism takes over with a force and a power not otherwise seen outside religion. A soldier who allows his own thoughts of consequentialist morality to persuade him not to go over the top would likely find himself court-martialed and even executed. The springboard for this discussion of moral philosophy was a hypothetical religious claim that, without a god, morals are relative and arbitrary. Kant and other sophisticated moral philosophers apart, and with due recognition given to patriotic fervour, the preferred source of absolute morality is usually a holy book of some kind, interpreted as having an authority far beyond its history's capacity to justify. Indeed, adherents of scriptural authority show distressingly little curiosity about the normally highly dubious historical origins of their holy books. The next chapter will demonstrate that in any case, people who claim to derive their morals from scripture do not really do so in practice. and a very good thing too, as they themselves, on reflection, should agree. Chapter 7. The Good Book and the Changing Moral Zeitgeist.
Politics has slain its thousands, but religion has slain its tens of thousands. Sean O'Casey.
There are two ways in which Scripture might be a source of morals or rules for living. One is by direct instruction, for example through the Ten Commandments, which are the subject of such bitter contention in the culture wars of America's boondocks. The other is by example. God or some other biblical character might serve as, to use the contemporary jargon, a role model. Both scriptural routes, if followed through religiously, the adverb is used in its metaphoric sense but with an eye to its origin, encourage a system of morals which any civilized modern person, whether religious or not, would find, I can put it no more gently, obnoxious. To be fair, much of the Bible is not systematically evil, but just plain weird, as you would expect of a chaotically cobbled-together anthology of disjointed documents, composed, revised, translated, distorted, and improved by hundreds of anonymous authors, editors, and copyists, unknown to us, and mostly unknown to each other, spanning 9 centuries. This may explain some of the sheer strangeness of the Bible, but unfortunately it is this same weird volume that religious zealots hold up to us as the inerrant source of our morals and rules for living. Those who wish to base their morality literally on the Bible have either not read it or not understood it, as Bishop John Shelby Spong in The Sins of Scripture rightly observed. Bishop Spong, by the way, is a nice example of a liberal bishop whose beliefs are so advanced as to be almost unrecognizable to the majority of those who call themselves Christians. A British counterpart is Richard Holloway, recently retired as Bishop of Edinburgh. Bishop Holloway even describes himself as a recovering Christian. I had a public discussion with him in Edinburgh, which was one of the most stimulating and interesting encounters I've had.
The Old Testament. Begin in Genesis with the well-loved story of Noah, derived from the Babylonian myth of Utnapishtim and known from the older mythologies of several cultures. The legend of the animals going into the ark two by two is charming, but the moral of the story of Noah is appalling. God took a dim view of humans, so he, with the exception of one family, drowned the lot of them, including children, and also, for good measure, the rest of the presumably blameless animals as well. Of course, irritated theologians will protest that we don't take the book of Genesis literally anymore, but that is the whole point. We pick and choose which bits of Scripture to believe, which bits to write off as symbols or allegories. Such picking and choosing is a matter of personal decision, just as much or as little as the atheist's decision to follow this moral precept or that was a personal decision, without an absolute foundation. If one of these is morality flying by the seat of its pants, so is the other. In any case, despite the good intentions of the sophisticated theologian, a frighteningly large number of people still do take their scriptures, including the story of Noah, literally. According to Gallup, they include approximately 50% of the US electorate. Also, no doubt, many of those Asian holy men who blamed the 2004 tsunami not on a plate tectonic shift, but on human sins, ranging from drinking and dancing in bars to breaking some footling Sabbath rule. Steeped in the story of Noah, and ignorant of all except biblical learning, who can blame them? Their whole education has led them to view natural disasters as bound up with human affairs, paybacks for human misdemeanors, rather than anything so impersonal as plate tectonics. By the way, what presumptuous egocentricity to believe that earth-shaking events, on the scale at which a god or a tectonic plate might operate, must always have a human connection. Why should a divine being, with creation and eternity on his mind, care a fig for petty human malefactions? We humans give ourselves such airs, even aggrandizing our pokey little sins to the level of cosmic significance.
When I interviewed for television the Reverend Michael Bray, a prominent American anti-abortion activist, I asked him why evangelical Christians were so obsessed with private sexual inclinations, such as homosexuality, which didn't interfere with anybody else's life. His reply invoked something like self-defense. Innocent citizens are at risk of becoming collateral damage when God chooses to strike a town with a natural disaster because it houses sinners. In 2005, the fine city of New Orleans was catastrophically flooded in the aftermath of a hurricane, Katrina. The Reverend Pat Robertson, one of America's best-known televangelists and a former presidential candidate, was reported as blaming the hurricane on a lesbian comedian who happened to live in New Orleans. You'd think an omnipotent God would adopt a slightly more targeted approach to zapping sinners, a judicious heart attack, perhaps, rather than the wholesale destruction of an entire city just because it happened to be the domicile of one lesbian comedian. In November 2005, the citizens of Dover, Pennsylvania, voted off their local school board the entire slate of fundamentalists who had brought the town notoriety, not to say ridicule, by attempting to enforce the teaching of intelligent design. When Pat Robertson heard that the fundamentalists had been democratically defeated at the ballot, he offered a stern warning to Dover.
I'd like to say to the good citizens of Dover, if there is a disaster in your area, don't turn to God. You just rejected him from your city, and don't wonder why he hasn't helped you when problems begin, if they begin, and I'm not saying they will, but if they do, just remember, you just voted God out of your city, and if that's the case, then don't ask for his help, because he might not be there.
Pat Robertson would be harmless comedy were he less typical of those who today hold power and influence in the United States. In the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, the Noah equivalent, chosen to be spared with his family because he was uniquely righteous, was Abraham's nephew Lot. Two male angels were sent to Sodom to warn Lot to leave the city before the brimstone arrived. Lot hospitably welcomed the angels into his house, whereupon all the men of Sodom gathered around and demanded that Lot should hand the angels over so that they could, what else, sodomize them.
Where are the men which came in to thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may know them. Genesis 19:5.
Yes, no has the authorized version's usual euphemistic meaning, which is very funny in the context. Lot's gallantry in refusing the demand suggests that God might have been onto something when he singled him out as the only good man in Sodom. But Lot's halo is tarnished by the terms of his refusal.
I pray you, brethren, do not so wickedly. Behold now, I have two daughters, which have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you, and do ye to them as is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing, for therefore came they under the shadow of my roof. Genesis 19:7-8.
Whatever else this strange story might mean, it surely tells us something about the respect accorded to women in this intensely religious culture. As it happened, Lot's bargaining away of his daughter's virginity proved unnecessary, for the angels succeeded in repelling the marauders by miraculously striking them blind. They then warned Lot to decamp immediately with his family and his animals, because the city was about to be destroyed. The whole household escaped, with the exception of Lot's unfortunate wife, whom the Lord turned into a pillar of salt, because she committed the offence, comparatively mild one might have thought, of looking over her shoulder at the fireworks display.
Lot's two daughters make a brief reappearance in the story. After their mother was turned into a pillar of salt, they lived with their father in a cave up a mountain. Starved of male company, they decided to make their father drunk and copulate with him. Lot was beyond noticing when his elder daughter arrived in his bed or when she left, but he was not too drunk to impregnate her. The next night, the two daughters agreed it was the younger one's turn. Again, Lot was too drunk to notice, and he impregnated her too. Genesis 19:31-6. If this dysfunctional family was the best Sodom had to offer by way of morals, some might begin to feel a certain sympathy with God and his judicial brimstone.
The story of Lot and the Sodomites is eerily echoed in chapter 19 of the book of Judges, where an unnamed Levite priest was travelling with his concubine in Gibeah. They spent the night in the house of a hospitable old man. While they were eating their supper, the men of the city came and beat on the door, demanding that the old man should hand over his male guest, so that we may know him. In almost exactly the same words as Lot, the old man said,
Nay, my brethren, nay, I pray you, do not so wickedly. Seeing that this man is come into mine house, do not this folly. Behold, here is my daughter, a maiden, and his concubine. Them I will bring out now, and humble ye them, and do with them what seemeth good unto you, but unto this man do not so vile a thing. Judges 19:23-4.
Again the misogynistic ethos comes through loud and clear. I find the phrase, humble ye them, particularly chilling. Enjoy yourselves by humiliating and raping my daughter and this priest's concubine, but show a proper respect for my guest, who is, after all, male. In spite of the similarity between the two stories, the denouement was less happy for the Levite's concubine than for Lot's daughters. The Levite handed her over to the mob, who gang-raped her all night.
They knew her, and abused her all the night until the morning, and when the day began to spring, they let her go. Then came the woman in the dawning of the day, and fell down at the door of the man's house where her lord was, till it was light. Judges 19:25-6.
In the morning, the Levite found his concubine lying prostrate on the doorstep, and said, with what we today might see as callous abruptness,
Up, and let us be going.
But she didn't move. She was dead. So he
took a knife, and laid hold on his concubine, and divided her, together with her bones, into 12 pieces, and sent her into all the coasts of Israel.
Yes, you read correctly. Look it up in Judges 19:29. Let's charitably put it down again to the ubiquitous weirdness of the Bible. This story is so similar to that of Lot, one can't help wondering whether a fragment of manuscript became accidentally misplaced in some long-forgotten scriptorium, an illustration of the erratic provenance of sacred texts.
Lot's uncle Abraham was the founding father of all three great monotheistic religions. His patriarchal status renders him only somewhat less likely than God to be taken as a role model. But what modern moralist would wish to follow him? Relatively early in his long life, Abraham went to Egypt to tough out a famine with his wife Sarah. He realized that such a beautiful woman would be desirable to the Egyptians, and that therefore his own life as her husband might be endangered. So he decided to pass her off as his sister. In this capacity, she was taken into Pharaoh's harem, and Abraham consequently became rich in Pharaoh's favor. God disapproved of this cozy arrangement and sent plagues on Pharaoh and his house. Why not on Abraham? An understandably aggrieved Pharaoh demanded to know why Abraham had not told him Sarah was his wife. He then handed her back to Abraham and kicked them both out of Egypt, Genesis 12:18-19. Weirdly, it seems that the couple later tried to pull the same stunt again, this time with Abimelech, the king of Gerar. He, too, was induced by Abraham to marry Sarah, again having been led to believe she was Abraham's sister, not his wife, Genesis 20:2-5. He, too, expressed his indignation, in almost identical terms to Pharaoh's, and one can't help sympathizing with both of them. Is the similarity another indicator of textual unreliability? Such unpleasant episodes in Abraham's story are mere peccadilloes compared with the infamous tale of the sacrificing of his son Isaac. Muslim scripture tells the same story about Abraham's other son, Ishmael. God ordered Abraham to make a burnt offering of his longed-for son. Abraham built an altar, put firewood upon it, and trussed Isaac up on top of the wood. His murdering knife was already in his hand when an angel dramatically intervened with the news of a last-minute change of plan. God was only joking, after all, tempting Abraham and testing his faith. A modern moralist cannot help but wonder how a child could ever recover from such psychological trauma. By the standards of modern morality, this disgraceful story is an example, simultaneously, of child abuse, bullying in two asymmetrical power relationships, and the first recorded use of the Nuremberg defense, I was only obeying orders. Yet the legend is one of the great foundational myths of all three monotheistic religions.
Once again, modern theologians will protest that the story of Abraham sacrificing Isaac should not be taken as literal fact. And once again, the appropriate response is twofold. First, many, many people, even to this day, do take the whole of their scripture to be literal fact, and they have a great deal of political power over the rest of us, especially in the United States and in the Islamic world. Second, if not as literal fact, how should we take the story? As an allegory? Then an allegory for what? Surely nothing praiseworthy. As a moral lesson? But what kind of morals could one derive from this appalling story? Remember, all I'm trying to establish for the moment is that we do not, as a matter of fact, derive our morals from Scripture. Or if we do, we pick and choose among the Scriptures for the nice bits and reject the nasty. But then we must have some independent criterion for deciding which are the moral bits. A criterion which, wherever it comes from, cannot come from Scripture itself, and is presumably available to all of us, whether we are religious or not. Apologists even seek to salvage some decency for the God character in this deplorable tale. Wasn't it good of God to spare Isaac's life at the last minute? In the unlikely event that any of my readers are persuaded by this obscene piece of special pleading, I refer them to another story of human sacrifice, which ended more unhappily. In Judges, chapter 11, the military leader Jephthah made a bargain with God that, if God would guarantee Jephthah's victory over the Ammonites, Jephthah would, without fail, sacrifice as a burnt offering whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return. Jephthah did indeed defeat the Ammonites, with a very great slaughter, as is par for the course in the book of Judges, and he returned home victorious. Not surprisingly, his daughter, his only child, came out of the house to greet him with timbrels and dances. And alas, she was the first living thing to do so. Understandably, Jephthah rent his clothes, but there was nothing he could do about it. God was obviously looking forward to the promised burnt offering, and in the circumstances, the daughter very decently agreed to be sacrificed. She asked only that she should be allowed to go into the mountains for 2 months to bewail her virginity. At the end of this time, she meekly returned, and Jephthah cooked her. God did not see fit to intervene on this occasion.
God's monumental rage whenever his chosen people flirted with a rival god resembles nothing so much as sexual jealousy of the worst kind, and again it should strike a modern moralist as far from good role model material. The temptation to sexual infidelity is readily understandable even to those who do not succumb, and it is a staple of fiction and drama from Shakespeare to bedroom farce. But the apparently irresistible temptation to whore with foreign gods is something we moderns find harder to empathize with. To naive eyes, "Thou shalt have no other gods but me," would seem an easy enough commandment to keep, a doddle one might think compared with "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbour's wife, or her ass, or her ox." Yet throughout the Old Testament, with the same predictable regularity as in bedroom farce, God had only to turn his back for a moment, and the children of Israel would be often at it with Baal or some trollop of a graven image, or on one calamitous occasion, a golden calf.
Moses, even more than Abraham, is a likely role model for followers of all three monotheistic religions. Abraham may be the original patriarch, but if anybody should be called the doctrinal founder of Judaism and its derivative religions, it is Moses. On the occasion of the golden calf episode, Moses was safely out of the way up Mount Sinai, communing with God and getting tablets of stone graven by him. The people down below, who were on pain of death to refrain from so much as touching the mountain, didn't waste any time.
"When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron, and said unto him, Up, make us gods, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what is become of him." Exodus 32:1.
Aaron got everybody to pool their gold, melted it down, and made a golden calf, for which newly invented deity he then built an altar so that they could all start sacrificing to it. Well, they should have known better than to fool around behind God's back like that. He might be up a mountain, but he was, after all, omniscient, and he lost no time in dispatching Moses as his enforcer. Moses raced hot foot down the mountain, carrying the stone tablets on which God had written the Ten Commandments. When he arrived and saw the golden calf, he was so furious that he dropped the tablets and broke them. God later gave him a replacement set, so that was all right. Moses seized the golden calf, burned it, ground it to powder, mixed it with water, and made the people swallow it. Then he told everybody in the priestly tribe of Levi to pick up a sword and kill as many people as possible. This amounted to about 3,000, which, one might have hoped, would have been enough to assuage God's jealous sulk. But no, God wasn't finished yet. In the last verse of this terrible chapter, his parting shot was to send a plague upon what was left of the people.
Because they made the calf, which Aaron made.
The book of Numbers tells how God incited Moses to attack the Midianites. His army made short work of slaying all the men, and they burned all the Midianite cities, but they didn't kill the women and children. This merciful restraint by his soldiers infuriated Moses, and he gave orders that all the boy children should be killed, and all the women who were not virgins.
But all the women children that have not known a man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. Numbers 31:18.
No, Moses was not a great role model for modern moralists. Insofar as modern religious writers attach any kind of symbolic or allegorical meaning to the massacre of the Midianites, the symbolism is aimed in precisely the wrong direction. The unfortunate Midianites, so far as one can tell from the biblical account, were the victims of genocide in their own country. Yet their name lives on in Christian lore only in that favourite hymn, which I can still sing from memory after 50 years to 2 different tunes, both in grim minor keys.
Christian, dost thou see them on the holy ground? How the troops of Midian prowl and prowl around. Christian, up and smite them, counting gain but loss. Smite them by the merit of the holy cross.
Alas, poor slandered, slaughtered Midianites. To be remembered only as poetic symbols of universal evil in a Victorian hymn. The rival god Baal seems to have been a perennially seductive tempter to wayward worship. In Numbers chapter 25, many of the Israelites were lured by Moabite women to sacrifice to Baal. God reacted with characteristic fury. He ordered Moses to
take all the heads of the people and hang them up before the Lord against the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may be turned away from Israel.
One cannot help yet again marvelling at the extraordinarily draconian view taken of the sin of flirting with rival gods. To our modern sense of values and justice, it seems a trifling sin, compared to, say, offering your daughter for a gang rape. It is yet another example of the disconnect between scriptural and modern, one is tempted to say civilized, morals. Of course, it is easily enough understood in terms of the theory of memes, and the qualities that a deity needs in order to survive in the meme pool. The tragi-farce of God's maniacal jealousy against alternative gods recurs continually throughout the Old Testament. It motivates the first of the 10 commandments, the ones on the tablets that Moses broke, Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5, and it is even more prominent in the otherwise rather different substitute commandments that God provided to replace the broken tablets, Exodus 34. Having promised to drive out of their homelands the unfortunate Amorites, Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hevites, and Jebusites, God gets down to what really matters, rival gods.
Ye shall destroy their altars, break their images, and cut down their groves. For thou shalt worship no other god, for the Lord whose name is Jealous is a jealous god. Lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they go a-whoring after their gods, and do sacrifice unto their gods, and one call thee, and thou eat of his sacrifice, and thou take of their daughters unto thy sons, and their daughters go a-whoring after their gods, and make thy sons go a-whoring after their gods. Thou shalt make thee no molten gods. Exodus 34:13-17.
I know, yes, of course, times have changed and no religious leader today, apart from the likes of the Taliban or the American Christian equivalent, thinks like Moses. But that is my whole point. All I'm establishing is that modern morality, wherever else it comes from, does not come from the Bible. Apologists cannot get away with claiming that religion provides them with some sort of inside track to defining what is good and what is bad, a privileged source unavailable to atheists. they cannot get away with it, not even if they employ that favourite trick of interpreting selected scriptures as symbolic rather than literal. By what criterion do you decide which passages are symbolic, which literal?